there's very real fear.
Oh, yeah.
That even being a naturalized citizen was not enough to protect me. Yeah. And that whole idea of, you know, not being good enough or not quite fitting into society, after having spent all of this time and effort being a part of this fabric and feeling as if, wow, you know, with one stroke, this person can make me feel or mm-hmm. make me really not be the same
right.
as everyone else.
This is the Radicals and Revolutionaries Lab. I'm Jillian Foster. This is the show that asks, what does feminism even look like? What do these power bitches do? Where do these provocateurs come from? And how can we get more of that glow? Join us as we dive into feminist awakenings and work that refuses to obey the rules.
My name is Aarti Stolge-Kreibich. I am running for Congress in New Jersey's 5th District. I am a mom, a council member, a immigrant, and I love food just as much as Jillian does.
Yes, we're food lovers. All right, perfect. Okay, so tell me about your work.
So the work I'm doing now is not something that, you know, even 5 years ago, I thought I'd be doing. So it's been this great
change. I think we met 5 years ago.
Yes,
even.
We did.
And you were being a neuroscientist.
I was.
You were working at a charity that deals, what is it that they deal with? I forget. I was trying to explain this to someone the other day.
Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So we're looking for a treatment for Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
Yeah. So that's what you were doing at the time.
Yeah.
And now fast forward, you're now a councilwoman, is that right?
Yep. I'm a council member in a small town in Jersey.
Yes.
And
running for Congress. I can't even believe it.
Congress. It's a whole different world than it was 5 years ago in multiple ways.
What kinds of things are you passionate about right now? You know, back then it was neuroscience, and I'm sure you're still quite interested in neuroscience, but like what kind of top of mind things are you really working on at the moment that you're like, I must fix these?
There's so many.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole
world. It feels
world,
a little bit like we're in a dumpster fire situation
exactly.
at the
it's
moment.
Like the whole world is on fire. So everything that I was passionate about before is something I'm still passionate about. The number one thing is that I feel as if we don't have the right people stepping up to fix them.
Mm.
And, you know, I've been waiting. I've been waiting for other people to step up, and they haven't done it.
Yeah.
So clearly—
There's so many mediocre, lazy motherfuckers out there.
Yes. And how do they get in power and stay in power?
It boggles my mind.
Yeah, it's because we let them.
Yeah. I think there is like this, I've been thinking about it a lot, kind of like, you have to support the change that you want to see happen. Like, we can talk all we want, but like, unless you step up, whether it's with your time, talents, or resources, like, nothing's going to fucking change.
Yeah. If we want that, if that's what we're demanding, then we need to demand more of ourselves. And that was essentially what happened after the 2016 election, right? So we had this election that was shocking. That was this like this line in my life, you know, clear demarcation before and after.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so than when my kids were born, which is saying something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that totally freaking changes your mind. Well,
yeah, for sure.
So, you know, we had this crazy, crazy election where somebody was elected who I never thought in my lifetime would be elected in America, right?
Right. Like, it's like, what kind of bizarro world is this?
Right. And so you're sitting around, looking around, going, who the hell elected him? Who voted for him and why?
Right. I, after the 2016 election, I was trying to figure out, like, what am I more afraid of? Am I more afraid that Trump is in office or that I'm surrounded by people that voted for Trump?
Exactly.
Like, what is worse? I don't know.
And that who seem to be blind to the kinds of things that he stands for. And clearly, well, however many years later, it feels like decades, but it's only apparently three. We're still, you know, we don't even see the impact yet. Mm-hmm. And we're going to continue to see it. So after 2016, I sat there and I said, no, we can't do this. And the thing that actually that got to me was, you know, I was devastated. My kids were devastated. They had come out and canvassed, you know, with me, including the day of the election. We were all ready to, you know, celebrate. Like, my kids went out. I went out with them in pantsuits, right? Like, out in Pennsylvania.
I think I remember that. That's so cute.
They were so into this. They were like, this is great. We were knocking on doors. You know, we thought we were celebrating. And it was devastating. It was genuinely devastating to them the next day when they realized what had happened.
Yeah.
And it was devastating to me. And I was going around in this, you know, nice community, which we love to live in, which we, you know, which we moved to several years ago. And it didn't seem as if it was bothering a whole lot of people. Or if it was, it was bothering them on the inside and nobody was really talking about it outside. And so, you know, even on social media, which, you know, in small towns.
You have like a Facebook group for your neighborhood.
There are
or something?
Multiple ones, yeah.
Oh, okay.
For the town, nobody was talking about it at all. And I thought, well, how can this be possible? There was this huge devastating change that has occurred. And even if you didn't feel it was devastating, it was a shocking change, I thought. And nobody was talking about it at all. It was as if we were just going to ignore this and keep on going with our lives. Mm. And I thought, how privileged can we be? Can anybody be to not even be talking about this? So it started off as a relatively innocuous post where I posted in one of our, you know, Facebook groups. And I said, you know, regardless how who you voted for, understand that there are people out there that are feeling way more vulnerable today than they were yesterday. And they're feeling way more insecure today than they were yesterday. And it was, you know, it was as neutral as I could make it. And I just thought it was, you know, maybe people didn't understand. Maybe people didn't understand why folks were worried and afraid and upset.
Sure.
And this was now like 2 days later. And the very first comment I got was gaslighting.
Oh my gosh.
I think you're looking at mainstream media and I think, you know, something along those lines.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at my literal actual life.
Yeah. And my friends and my relatives.
Wow.
And I thought, well, there is something wrong where we're not talking and that,
yeah.
But I got all these private messages with people or texts where they were like, I'm so glad you said this. I've been feeling this way. I've been afraid of saying this. I've been afraid of who voted for whom. I don't even know who to trust anymore, which was sort of this underlying, you know, theme there.
Right.
And I thought, wow, this is a different world. You know, I'm posting something, the comment, at least the first couple of comments I'm getting are gaslighting, you're imagining things. And then all of these private messages I'm getting are like, oh my God, thank you for saying this. I'm like, how can we make this happen so that people, we're actually talking to each other and helping each other understand?
Right.
Well, first, it's mind-boggling that people actually say this is in your head, but.
Yeah, I have to say, it is really mind-boggling, but maybe some people are genuinely living that sheltered of
exactly.
a life. Like,
exactly.
It's really like, how do you not, what I don't understand is like, how do you not see the linkages to past atrocities? Like, I mean, as simple as like the Holocaust, for example, like.
I agree completely.
I mean, it's like, there's direct linkages. It's like, he's going to come for everyone eventually. Like, this is fucked.
Yeah. So I was giving them the benefit of the doubt. And I thought, you know, really it was important to, for people to step up and say like, you know, we can't be silent, right? Let me talk about how this makes me feel. Let me be braver and more vulnerable and more outspoken in our community.
So lovely.
Because
this is really brave, yeah.
Well, I think to me, it was always less brave and more just necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, because if it was me and I see all these people saying, yes, I'm with you, and I'm like, they can't speak out for whatever reason, then I need to be the one
right.
speaking out. And so that's how that journey started. And so, and then another person who I didn't know at the time is now a really good friend said, hey, there's a women's march happening. Does anyone want to come out and, you know, from this community? And at the end of the day, we had, I think, three buses go down, 200 something women from Glen Rock, small town, going down to DC.
That's great.
It was amazing. It was a great experience because not just because of the march and how we felt, but really because of the camaraderie in the community. I mean, I met people I had no idea existed in my town before.
Right, right.
And a bunch of them are on my campaign now.
Fantastic.
And we're just really great friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never have met them otherwise. At the end, as we were coming back in the bus, we were talking and I said, you know, we really need more women to step up in government. You know, what I'm going to do is try and get folks together and see how else we can have this community that we found in the bus, but in real life. Right.
Right.
Along with three other women, I formed Glen Rock After the March, which was a Facebook group, but also a real life group. And now we're, I think, more than 900 people, at least on Facebook.
That's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. And we came together and it was really just supposed to be a community to talk about this, a safe space for all the people and more who were private messaging me and other people saying, like, this is how I feel about this, to
right.
come together. And that's how the whole thing started. And yeah, it made me feel good in a way, but also even better when I started meeting these people in real life and we started talking about why we felt, how we did about things and what we needed to change in our community.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you looked around, I didn't see people with all the different experiences I have making the decisions for me in
right.
our town.
Right.
And I thought, well, so I'm buying into this whole idea of local change beginning at home, right? The fact that, okay, we can't do anything on that national level because we have this awful president, but let's make sure that we are doing everything we can to shore it up, you know, on all the different levels before. So I was looking around and I was agitating and asking all these new friends that I've made, you should run, you should run. And they looked back and they said, no, you should run. And I thought, well, that's weird. No, that's not what I am. I'm a scientist. This is what I do. But at the end of the day, I realized, yeah, I was really passionate about making sure, one, to me, climate change was real, has been real for a long time.
I mean, and if you don't believe that at this point, I don't even know what to say.
I know, but even then, like even 3 years ago, it was something that we didn't really talk about. It was still controversial.
Yeah.
As a scientist living in a relatively wealthy suburb, I thought it was insane that we weren't doing more. It was insane that we were just kind of ignoring again, like this giant, you know, like the house is burning and we're just going to go over here and do, you know, mow the lawn. And that's not okay. It's not okay. And so that was one of the reasons, you know, I stepped up and I said, you know what? I don't think I'm going to win. But what's important to me is to have these issues as conversations.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that we need to elevate that because if this is what we're whispering about, this is what we're really thinking, why not have those conversations out loud amongst the entire community and bring people together? So that's why I initially ran. And amazingly enough, because of the amazing volunteer network I had and because of the community that came together, I won.
I can't even believe it. I say that as like, not, I mean, I believe that you're amazing. And obviously you should be, you know, leading hundreds of people, thousands. But I'm always amazed when people win because it feels like such a long shot.
Oh, it was.
And it feels like such a slog, like such a heavy lift to go from, you know, like a totally different career into politics, which feels like also just really a difficult industry to...
It was. Well, I was still working full-time.
Oh, you were? Yeah, oh, I didn't know that. Oh
yeah, at the same time. So I was campaigning kind of, you know, part-time.
Yeah.
Because this was just going to be like the thing that I was doing as a hobby, right?
Yeah.
This was the cause.
And
that
you're like, oh, should I won?
Yes. But it was great. By the time I actually won, you know, it was a whole different ballgame than the perspective I had in the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to say, you know, the whole thing was new, which was great. It was fantastic because, you know, we were all just relatively young people coming together, mostly women, coming together for a change and just making up our rules. We were saying, okay, we don't really know that much about running campaigns, although the two women, Laura and Leslie, who... one of my best friends now, you know, ran campaigns in Glen Rock a couple years before. But again, like in this sort of, we're just doing our own thing. We're not listening to the establishment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, this is what feels right for us way. And so when I was running, and again, long shot, nobody knew who I was really. Nobody knew what I stood for.
And then you went on your first go.
Yeah, well, Damn. It was a lot of hard work. It was knocking on doors and meeting people. And it was saying, like, this is who I am. This is what I stand for, which, by the way, is not super easy to do.
I was going
to
say, what do you do when you encounter someone who is, like, maybe just not nice or has views that are just, like, totally opposite of yours?
Yeah.
You know, I want to be kind and not say bizarre, but, you know,
well,
but
thankfully,
like, just,
there were only a few of those. I think most people, so what I found was that most people, when you knock on their door, they're going to open and they're going to, if they're home, and they're going to actually listen to what you're saying. I think the number one thing that taught me was that people really weren't reaching out to other people, that, like, just across the board. They would reach out to their friends and their friends' friends and maybe stop over there. And what we really wanted to do, what I really wanted to do, was knock, you know, as many doors as I could and get people out. And for us, it was also—
get the Stacey Abrams action going.
Yeah. And for us, it was also about making sure that Democrats, the folks who felt the way we did, were activated, especially after the 2016 election, right? And so I was proud of being a Democrat, and I said, this is shorthand for these values. Like, these are my values, and this is what that means, and this is why I'm telling you what my party is, because I think that's important, particularly in those times. And I think, by the way, I still think it's very important. And so that's how I won. And I'm really it was amazing. It was a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And it's been a thrill and it's been a challenge.
Yeah.
Really, in the 2 years that I've been doing this, it's been amazing. And I'm really proud of the work I've done on council. And I'm really proud of the folks who have supported me and who still support me.
Yeah.
That's been the best part, you know, about this journey. I really never thought that this is where I would be.
Yeah. I mean, I think it seems to me, I don't know everyone who's supporting you, obviously, but it seems to me that the reason that you resonate with a lot of people, the reason that you resonate with me is because you're like a whole person. Like, it's not like I'm voting for you because of, you know, X, Y, or Z politics. Right. It's like, I know you and I trust you as a person, and I've known you for years, and I trust you to be like honest, but also intelligent. And I think that's really important when we seem to be at a real, We're in real desperate times trying to seek the intelligent out, you know? It's, I don't know what the hell's going on, but, you know.
It's also authenticity.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and I was thinking about it. I was like, that's what I seek for in people that inspire me. And we should have elected officials that inspire us. And we had that in the president right before this
one. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Obama was so inspiring.
And unfortunately, we got complacent. I got complacent. I thought that because he was at the helm, that everything was okay.
Right.
And that, you know, the forces of good were always going to win.
Man, and then shitstorm happened.
I know. And I realized I was supposed to be a force for good and fighting over there. And I wasn't doing it quite as hard as I could have been.
And now you're like going with gusto.
I am.
Let's bend back in time.
Sure.
And start at the beginning of your life. Where were you born?
So I was born in India. I was born in Bombay. And I came here. So my story in the U.S. begins when I was 11.
I didn't realize you were 11 when you came over. I've always wondered this, the politics around Bombay versus Mumbai.
Yeah, so interesting.
What do you have? Is there like an opinion, like as an immigrant, do you feel a certain way about it?
Or? So I was always Bombay when I was there. When I came here and they changed it to Mumbai, I thought, well, okay, that makes sense because Mumbai is, you know, what you call it in Marathi, and that was my first language.
Yeah.
And, you know, so to me, Mumbai makes sense, you know, in a real way. I have issues with some of the nationalism.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's intense nationalism going on in India.
Yeah. And I think, and I have real issues with that.
Yeah.
As proud as I am of being Indian, as proud as I am about my roots, my culture, about all the amazing good things it is to be in India and being part of the largest democracy, the nationalism there, is problematic. And I think
It's definitely taken on an intensely problematic tone along with us. Like this is like a wave throughout the world that seems to be happening.
Exactly. And I think actually climate change is both the root and will exacerbate this.
Oh, really?
I personally believe that that's true.
I mean, I definitely can see that. I'm curious. Can you tell me more? I'm curious what you think about it.
I think that we have roots of... When we have the intense weather that we're going to be having, when we have issues with our food supply and our water supply, which, by the way, have already started. Mm-hmm. So droughts, famines, issues with, you know, crops failing have been happening. So, for example, in India and other parts of the world for a long time now, and including our farmers in the U.S. have known about this for a while. And it's been happening. The rest of us who live in urban and suburban areas don't pay attention because we still get, you know, we have such an abundance in our country and we still get food from places, even though we might grumble about a dollar here or there. It's not affecting our daily lives yet.
Right.
But it will be.
Yeah. I don't think people realize when it does affect your daily life, then it becomes really intense really fast.
Exactly.
And people, you can get to a point where you spend all of your time looking for food and water and shelter, which is not a place that is fantastic.
You and know, this is where really you have difficult. Refugees.
Right? Exactly.
So you have increased refugees. You have increased violence because there's less abundance. So here you are, we're going back into our tribal mindset.
Right.
And so anybody who's different in any way, shape, or form, there's going to be increased conflict of. And I think there's increased gender violence.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think there is increased hostility across the board.
Right.
So instead of going towards to a society where we're coming together and collaborating and actually trying to reach for that equity that we're always reaching for, inequality, instead we are actually fragmented. And unfortunately, what we're doing is electing leaders that are intensifying those conflicts.
Right. What kills me is that we do, I feel strongly that we actually have at our disposal ways to solve these problems, to find workarounds. Humans as a species are very resilient. And I think we have options, we have ways, but what we can't find those options and ways if some of us are fucking hoarding everything.
Yes.
And everyone else is struggling and just trying to survive. Like it doesn't actually work. That equation does not work out.
Yeah.
And so there's got to be a way that we can solve what is a fallacy. It's a lie. Scarcity is a lie that patriarchy tells us in an effort to divide us and keep us fighting one another. If we work together, there is actually abundance that we can share, but some of us can't be hoarding everything.
I agree completely. I think that's exactly it. So we are electing leaders, and we are electing leaders at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, in various different countries, internationally, who are sitting there going, hey, each for our own. Mm-hmm. And this is how we're going to do it. Instead of actually thinking about the fact that, yeah, you know what? Everything we do is interconnected, affects everyone else. And here's how we can make things better for all of us.
Exactly. Exactly. So you lived the first 11 years of your life in India. Anything that comes forward about that time, formative roots that made you the powerful woman you are today?
I think that, you know, I was actually thinking about this recently. I think I've always been a feminist and just never understood that, even as a young child.
Right,
I've always rebelled in different ways. And what you said about the patriarchy is exactly right. India is such a patriarchal society, has been for a long time, and definitely was when I was growing up. And to me, I always chafed against that. Mm. And I couldn't articulate it when I was younger. I couldn't quite figure out why something like this made me really angry, or why expectations that I would always cook, or I would have to, or the expectation really was I was not supposed to really go to college. Or if I did, that was okay, but not really study for that long, you know, because I was supposed to get married.
Right. You can go to college, but that's not really the purpose of your life.
Exactly. You know? And it wasn't ever anything that was explicitly stated. It was just something that was there when I was, especially when I was younger. I will say that my mom always encouraged me to have an education. She always encouraged the kinds of things that I wanted to do that were maybe not always so traditional.
What I love about this is that, like, this is the story of your life, but also so many women experience this. Like, I am not from India. I didn't grow up in your household, but I did grow up in a religious environment where it was explicit that, like, you get an education, but really, like, the point is for you to be a mom.
Yeah.
You know, you, through your mother's support, kind of pushed through that. And in a fairly dramatic way, you got a PhD.
Yes. And I will say that as much as my mom loves me and supports me, she really, really, really wanted me to have an MD. And so my idea of a rebellion was to get a PhD instead. Gotten a little bit better at rebellion since then.
It's like the nerdy rebellion.
Yes, exactly. It's like, nope, I'm not going to conform. I'm going to do something else. Nerdy. No, but really, you know, the expectations. So I came here when I was 11. You know, my dad had come here a couple years earlier to save up money and bring us over.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So I was home with my mom and my two younger brothers. So I actually distinctly remember my first plane ride coming here, like trying to hang on to my brothers as they were like running around, you know, trying to
go. Oh my gosh. What was it like when you first arrived?
It was crazy. I was so excited and anxious and scared and, you know, really filled with both hope and like this unrealistic hope because, you know, America was always touted as this like land where things were going to get better, right? Yeah. But also just anxiety because it was like a whole different world and I didn't know, you know, I mean, even that plane ride was just crazy, you know? And I think about my kids who've been on planes since they were, you know, babies and it's a whole, you know, it's like, wow, it's a lot different. I mean, for example, the culture shock was crazy. So we came here and I came from a place where we didn't have TV 24 hours and it was black and white. Mm. And I just, it was like crazy. But the first 24 hours that we were here, I stayed up, I had jet lag and I was mesmerized by the fact that there was color on the TV.
Oh, this is so sweet as a child. Oh,
I know. And then of course we didn't have a remote control. So we would like have to tag to.
Someone had to get up and change the channel.
Rotary dial, which was, you know, just a whole different ballgame. But no, it was definitely a culture shock. So I came from a place where everybody looked like everybody else, you know, to a certain extent. And everybody spoke multiple languages to a place where everybody looked different than me. And where you really predominantly only spoke one language. And if you spoke anything else at the time, it meant you were less than.
Where did you move to? Like, where was your home?
So we moved to Queens, to Jamaica.
Okay.
which, by the way, is, you know, of course, multicultural. I can't imagine what my life
would have
been like.
Queens is, like, so diverse.
It is. And even then, it felt not so diverse to me, right, when I came in. So I can't imagine what my life would have been like if we'd, like, lived, you know, somewhere else.
Oh, man, yeah.
At all. But what I got out of being here is really this sense of possibility. And that's what, you know, my parents always strove towards. They were always like, if you work hard, you can make it, right? And so we bought into the American dream.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were lucky. It worked for us. It doesn't work for everybody.
No, it's really, it like takes a lot of factors, I think, to line up.
And so for us, you know, especially, and I was blind to that growing up, and I was blind to that even, you know, I think after I got a college degree, about really how many factors have to line up for it to work for you, but also how many systemic factors there are that keep other people down.
Yeah. And I part of me wants to believe in the American dream because it's like, it's like a, it kind of can propel you forward. It's a driver, you know, it can really like ignite you. But at the same time, there's so many like fallacies wrapped up in it. And it doesn't take into account histories, like the fact that the country itself was built on racism.
Exactly.
And like, how do you even get away from that? I don't.
You can't. And then here's the thing. So you have, you know, immigrant populations coming in, getting a foot up, right? Mm-hmm. And not, and being completely blind to this entire history of slavery, which, you know, while we even talk about in the education system, I mean, I was here from sixth grade onwards. It's really has been sort of a footnote rather than central.
Oh, yeah.
Which is exactly what it is, central to our history.
Exactly. Going back to podcasts, when I listened to 1619, all I could think was, if only we had just listened to this.
Yeah.
Like if literally there was no lecture, if the whole class was just listening to this podcast, it is so informative.
Yeah.
And like none of this is taught.
It isn't. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really passionate about, especially with my own kids, is to make sure they understand as much as they possibly can from an early age that what we have is because we're fortunate and because we have immense privilege and because the systems have been put into place that actually benefit us, benefit me, and benefit them. Mm-hmm. And that it's our responsibility to make sure that we don't take advantage of that, that we are also leaving room for other people, that we're also bringing other people along and giving up some of that hoarding.
Right, right. It's really like I think about this a lot too, like kind of maybe, and you can reflect on like your life and your work now, like what is our responsibility? Because most people are not super, super wealthy. Most people have to work one, if not multiple jobs, especially households have to have at least two incomes now. Like it's just really, everyone is really working their ass off. But we also have, many of us have these structures and systems kind of leaning in our favor. And so then what is your responsibility if it's leaning in your favor? You know, what do you do?
You know, I think that what we need to do is come back to that narrative that we talked about earlier about we have this narrative that we've bought into this idea in America that somehow being wealthy equals being good.
Yes. It's like, what is that called? Something gospel. It's the idea of wealthiness equals righteousness.
Yes.
Like equals goodness.
Exactly.
You know?
And
prosperity gospel. Yeah, that's what it is.
And to me, that is what we need to start tackling, right? So that is giving rise to this whole trickle-down economics, the whole idea that the rich can do no wrong. So now not only do they have money and power, we're just, the rest of us are just giving them more money and more power, and we're enacting systems in place that just keep that going.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, we need to sit there and say, no, that's not okay. It is not okay for the very few people in the world to have all the power and not share it, and for us to continue that. And it's really, like, when you talk about it in a political sense, when I'm looking at it, it's not about which party you belong to, although, frankly, if you belong to the Republican Party right now.
Oh, no, what's going on there?
Right. But it's also about the up and down, right? Mm-hmm. It's also about the kinds of policies we enact to make sure things are more equal. So let's talk about things like healthcare, right?
Right.
Let's talk about things that we're clearly, what we're doing is we're making sure the people who are wealthy and who can afford things, who, you know, those people are going to be okay. And then the rest of us, we're not quite sure where we are.
Right.
So when we sit there and we talk about things like single payer systems, when we talk about things like Medicare for all, we get all this pushback because, oh my gosh, you're going to tax us a little bit more. And absolutely, it is going to cost a little bit more. Right. Of course, that's going to happen. But then what's the cost of not doing it?
This is what I don't understand. Like the logic is totally there for me because I'm like, I've been off and on insurance for basically my whole adult life. I was even once denied insurance.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. Yeah. It's like, and it was an administrative error for the reason I was denied. And I didn't have it for like a year. It was just absurd. And there was no workaround. I find insurance completely ridiculous. I hate it so much.
Nobody likes
insurance. But then living without insurance is also really precarious and crazy expensive.
Yes.
So what I don't get is like, if you don't have insurance, it's probably going to cost you X number of dollars to have any sort of medical treatment, even if it's just minor, right? Like if you go to urgent care, it's like $125 typically. Yeah. And almost anywhere in the country.
Yeah.
So then if you do have insurance, you're paying a premium. Okay. But then if you have Medicare for all, you're going to be taxed higher, but maybe that's the price of the premium. Like, this is what I don't get. I'm like, if you just make it all add up.
Yeah.
Like, who the fuck cares where it's coming from or going? Like, as long as you have some sort of coverage, I don't see what the problem is.
Yeah. And not just that, but like everyone, healthcare should be a right. It should not be like, a privilege.
If you break your leg, you should be able to get fixed without going into insane debt.
Yeah. And so here's why. So you work 1, 2, 3 jobs. If you have insurance, a chunk of that money is going towards that. But if you don't, you're still working those jobs and you are afraid. I remember there was a time where we didn't have insurance and my parents would joke about this. It'd be like, don't get sick. Don't get sick.
Right.
Can't afford it. Or, hey, you know what? For this short period of time, we picked up dental insurance. All right, let's go get all your dental work.
Yeah, everyone get everything done now.
Exactly. I'm like, that's a ridiculous way of living.
Right.
And that keeps people down. And there's so many people, I do these, you know, now meet and greets and things along those lines. But even just when I'm out and about and talking to people, every single time, there's at least one person who did not take a job that was a better job for them, that was going to have more opportunity for them because either they couldn't get health insurance or they had to wait too long or they had a pre-existing condition. So I'm like, so what are we doing? We're keeping people down. I have friends who wanted to start businesses or expand their businesses. So let's talk about American Ingenuity and all the things that we talk about. They couldn't do it because, again, health insurance is really expensive.
Right.
Trying to navigate that system is really expensive and cost prohibitive. So when you look at it from all different points of view, those systems are set up to make sure that the poor stay poor and don't have this upward mobility quite as much as, you know, they need to. And then the rich get richer.
Right, right. I think what's lost for me in a lot of discussions with those that are on the other spectrum of politics, if you will, those of the more conservative bent, is this idea that, you know, to have the American dream, if you believe in it, to have American ingenuity, to have innovation, you know what you need? You need a safety net.
Yeah.
You need something that people can fall back on so that they know they will have food and water and a house.
Yep.
Like basics, people.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, then people cannot innovate. People won't take chances and risks.
It is impossible to. I mean, having grown up, look, I was lucky. We were not wealthy by any means at all. But we always had a place to stay. We always had some kind of basics. And yes, we had to think about them long and hard, right? We didn't eat out. We had a lot of struggles. And when you have that mindset, even within that, when you have that mindset, it is really difficult to take risks.
Right.
It is really difficult for my parents to approve of this crazy choice of not being a doctor. Because for them, doctor was a steady income.
Right.
It's you're set for life. We don't have to worry about you. This other thing, we don't know what you're doing. We don't know where you're going to get a paycheck from, right? So let's talk about that even in that little context. So what you're doing is, again, you're putting people into these narrow spaces and not giving them room to expand, not giving them room to take chances, not letting them be creative at all. And so you're crumbling their spirit, but you're also just buying into the system that keeps you down.
Right. The forebearer or the mother of innovation is creativity.
Yeah.
And so it's like without that safety net, then we don't have innovation. And innovation is, frankly, in my opinion, one of the few things that really makes the U.S. unique and great.
Yeah.
There's two things I really love about the U.S., this drive, this innovation, and I really love our diversity of food. Every time I leave the U.S., I always miss our food. So
it's true.
I like to have all sorts of cuisines, you know? So So these are the things that make us so great. And both of them rely on diversity. They rely on having different humans, different backgrounds, people that look and experience the world differently and, you know, have a different kind of like a view on things. This all is required and we need this safety net. I'm so glad that you're working toward making the safety net stronger.
I think we all need to. And I think that there's more of us that actually believe in that, right? And I think that it doesn't matter really to a large extent where you fall on the socioeconomic or political spectrum. Mm-hmm. When you actually talk to people about the issues in a very real way, like, do you want your elected officials, do you want people to be advocating so that we have this medical safety net for everybody? People are going to say yes.
I mean, of course.
Exactly. It's common sense. Do you want to make sure that people who come into this country are safe and are not put into cages? Yes.
Right. Like, I feel like we've really gotten away from like our basic
humanity,
like values, like,
yes.
Like what do we want kids to, you know, not get sick and be educated. I think that's pretty simple. Yeah. Like, let's go for that. Like, there's no reason to put children in cages. Like, let's just be decent humans, you
know? And let's not put blinders on while our planet is on fire.
Right.
We have scientists raising clarion calls who are yelling and screaming about the fact that we have less than 12 years to start to course correct. And we are still investing in fossil fuels. We're still sitting there talking about how, you know, that's something in a distant future and how it's okay. We're going to have to just worry about things right now. Mm-hmm. 12 years is not the distant future.
Oh my gosh, 12 years is actually not that far away. No. That's frightening.
It is frightening. And so
note to self, recycle more.
Why should consume less?
Consume less, yeah. No more plastic. More of the glass bottles.
And at the end of the day, like, let's talk about what we actually need to do. So we're in New Jersey, and no state really in the U.S. is immune from climate change. But New Jersey is one of the most vulnerable ones. And we have elected officials who don't even want to use the phrase climate change fairly recently. And that to me is...
It's just absurd.
It's pandering. What are you pandering to?
Like who? What, exactly. The 10 people that still believe that climate change is real? I mean, come on, get the fuck out of here.
And by the way, if they do, they are wrong. You know they are wrong. So guess what? As a leader, you're supposed to mold public opinion. You're supposed to explain why, right. What the truth is. Right. There is a line in the sand that you are supposed to not cross, right? Like, you can compromise on a bunch of things, but nobody should be compromising on what the truth is.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I can't with the level of mediocrity and idiocy with that. Like, what is it? This must be what is largely propelling you into this kind of latest
absolutely.
Run for office. Latest. It's only been 2 years since you ran. It's really like amazing.
It's snowballed. So what happened in 2016 with the Trump election, you know, personally was this whole, you know, kind of change in the way I felt like I needed to be more activated. And let me be clear, I have enough privilege at this point in my life that I can do this and kind of keep a hold on my full-time job. Not everyone is able to do that. Mm-hmm. So I'm aware of that as I'm going about doing this. And yeah, by the way, doing science and being a scientist is my first love. And if ever there was an ideal scenario where I didn't have to be doing this, yeah, I would be sitting there doing more things with science.
If the world wasn't on fire, we'd all be chilling by the beach or something.
Exactly. So this is what happened in 2016 with the Trump election. I was activated, and I thought this glimmer of hope that we had was the fact that we had elected a congressperson, we had elected a congress member that was a Democrat. We had flipped our district. So we had a Tea Party Republican for like a decade or longer.
Oh, wow.
It was terrible. It was horrible. And so I had supported, you know, for the time that I'd lived in the district, always supported the Democratic candidate. And so when the current Congressman Gottheimer came in, I was excited. I was like, great. You know what? It's horrible on a national level, but we have somebody who's going to stand up for us. I am really happy. We did a good job in this little tiny corner of our world, right?
Yeah, like job well done.
Exactly.
Pat on the back.
Yes. Yay. And from his very first vote, January 4th, 2017, was he broke with the other Democrats, came in with a bunch of Republicans, and decided to vote on rolling back the Obama regulations, including those on the environment that Obama had done last, you know.
Why would he do that? I don't even understand this. Like,
I agree. I don't understand either. So he had a very like bureaucratic explanation for it. It was a very puzzling vote. And I was like, yay, I was really happy. What the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Right? And it was very puzzling. He gave this like hand wavy explanation and it was puzzling. We're like, all right, nod and smile. Like, okay, maybe there's something there that I don't understand because I'm not tuned into politics as much. I'm not sure. So in parallel, as me starting Glen Rock after the march and getting in with the other grassroots groups. So in NJ5, we have at least 25 grassroots groups. I mean, it's amazing.
Damn, you guys are really on fire over there.
Yes, we are. It's amazing. The progressive, really the activists have shown up time and again. So from that very first vote to him becoming this co-chair of this very problematic Problem Solvers Caucus, which is supposed to be this bipartisan.
It's a nice name. I'll give him that.
It is a nice name. And I thought, great, you know, he's going to be a leader and try and find solutions for things that are really important, mm-hmm. like healthcare, like financial security and social security, like climate change, which in fact I've talked to him about personally. It's like, yeah. This is the existential threat that we have. I can't think of a bigger problem for the problem solvers to come together and talk on. Radio silence. I don't even know if it's been brought up. So it was just an excuse, in my opinion, and a lot of other people's opinions, to really undermine what was going on with progressive politics, with Democratic politics. And it was a way of...
What does he think about the impeachment? I'm curious.
That is such a good question. So for a long time, he's been silent. I have come out on impeachment, as have so many of us.
I mean, how can you be silent? Come on now.
He's been silent for a long time. He came out and really just waffled. He said he finally came out, even after the Blue Dogs came out, Mike Sherrill and a group, for the impeachment. He said he supported an impeachment inquiry. And then further explanation was, it depended on what it said.
I can't. Let me just, I'm going to date this so because this will come out later. So yep. I want people to know we're recording it on October 24th. So who knows what the hell will happen
yes.
on the 25th and forward. But as of this moment, mediocrity continues.
But it's not just mediocrity. To me, you're actively undermining the checks and balances of the Constitution. You're in Congress
oh, yeah.
to do your job. And your job, and one of the beautiful things about the U.S., is this whole idea and system of checks and balances. So guess what? Your job is to make sure that if there is corruption, which by the way, all the rest has been shown time and again.
I mean, it is what it is. It's out there. I'm just like, what are we doing now?
It's been recognized over and over again. There's more than ample evidence for impeachment inquiry times, you know, at least five at this point. He's still waffling and saying, I'm not sure. I'm going to look at all the facts. It's an inquiry. That's the
Come
whole
on,
point
dude.
Of it.
Like,
yeah. So not only just that, but, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back in multiple ways for me was the fact that in June, we had all the reports that were coming out about kids in cages, about the
yeah.
fact that they didn't have blankets, the fact that we were giving them toothpaste, but the fact that, I mean, family separating has been an atrocious thing we've been doing for far too long. Mm-hmm. But we were starting to get much more of these reports about this. Right after that, there was an appropriations bill that was coming up to give money to CBP and ICE. Millions of dollars that were coming up. So he led the charge, there's a Washington Post article on it, to make sure that Nancy Pelosi did not put in accountability and guardrails. He basically said, if you put that in, I have a whole bunch of votes that I've whipped up.
What's the justification on his side?
In my opinion, there's no justification. There's no justification. He came in, he said, great. And so now we passed a bill, both the Senate and the House passed a bill that had no accountability in it. Right after we have all of these instances of of these human rights violations
right.
that we as the U.S. are perpetrating. So put aside what you feel about undocumented immigrants, and let's just talk about the humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, like how do you look at yourself in the mirror when voting for something like that?
What,
or like
not
pushing,
just that, pushing.
Like who even are you?
Exactly. And I was like, so when you do that and I voted for you, I'm morally complicit in that decision-making.
Oh, I didn't think about that. That is a really good point,
and
actually.
To me, I was like, I cannot be complicit in this.
Right.
This is not what I stand for. This is not what most people I know stand for.
Right. Like, this is, like, we're all now wrapped up in that.
Exactly.
That's a really good point.
And how dare you? How dare you do this? Mm-hmm. And his explanation, which was just this, like, crazy, waffly political explanation, was, well, I don't think it would have passed. I don't think the Senate would have passed something like this. So what? Just because you don't think? You didn't actually try for it. You just don't even try? You don't even try to stand up for people?
Yeah, in fact, you actively worked against it. Rather than trying to get the votes in the correct direction, you just gave up and joined the side of the other, like the evil side. What
completely undermined any political force that we would have had. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me.
Yeah, understandable. So that was this June?
That was this June, yeah.
Not even that long ago.
Well, you know, we'd been unhappy. I've been unhappy with his votes for a long time. And I will say that he is, in my opinion, dismissive of women. He is dismissive of people who elected him and who really came out for him. So in 2018, when he was elected in 2016. In 2018, even though he had problematic votes, we thought, okay, there's nobody else. He's a Democrat. We got to keep the seat, right? So we came out, we held our nose and voted for him. Not just that. I mean, I had a huge get out the vote canvas for him in my backyard. We had like 50, 60 people show up. We knocked on doors. I mean, we gathered along with the 24 other grassroots organizations that are in NJ5. We came out, and I will say a few of my friends who coordinated this, I think we all cumulatively knocked over 30,000 doors for him.
Oh my gosh, that's so many. Wow.
And so he went in 2016 from winning by 2 points to in 2018 winning our district by 14 points.
Wow.
So that doesn't happen because you're this middling, waffling person.
Right.
That happens because the rest of us activate and we vote for you.
Right.
And we make sure that people are coming out for you. And guess what? In 2020, all of those people, they're not coming out for him.
No, no, no.
They're coming out for me in the primary.
Yeah, I mean, it's enough of this lazy motherfucker. Okay, so what's the timeline? Forgive me, I'm not very good at timelines and voting. I can't keep track of everything that's happening. To be honest, my brain is small.
We're gonna make you better. So the primary is June 2nd, 2020.
Okay, so that's a Democratic primary in your district.
In my district.
NJ5.
It's a Democratic primary sort of everywhere in New Jersey.
Okay.
And my district, NJ5, it's I'm the only one challenging him because people are too darn scared. We've been made scared by the establishment. We've been told that he has a huge corporate war chest. So don't you dare even primary him.
I'm sorry, I can't. Like, democracy, you should be primaried anytime anyone wants to run. Like,
primaries are good for democracy.
Exactly. This is like, you're supposed to be involved and active in democracy, not like sitting around. Otherwise, if you're not involved, it's a dictatorship. Like,
exactly. The politics of fear are really why Trump won.
Yeah.
In one way, shape, or form.
Actually, that's a good point. Yeah.
And politics of fear, no matter what party you are, should not be the way we do business anymore.
No way. Okay, so you'll primary in June.
So if I win and I get the Democratic nomination, then the general election is in November in 2020, the same as the presidential general election.
Yes, that's a big, huge race.
It's going to be a huge race. It's a moonshot. It's a moonshot to do all of it because I'm hoping that we're going to activate enough people who come out and we're going to activate enough progressive Democrats and Democrats who actually believe in the real democratic values, which is really what I'm standing for.
Yeah.
And they're going to come out on primary day and they're going to vote for me.
Do you think that people really resonate with your story? I mean, this is like a leading question. I think they do resonate with your story, but I'm curious because your story is different than mine, right? Like my family, we were immigrants at some point, who knows when. I don't even know my whole past history, but at some point, but not in my lifetime. Like I wasn't an immigrant myself. And so I'm curious how people have resonated with that story and like really felt maybe closer to you as a result, because it's like a really authentic you, you know?
You know, I think at the end of the day, everybody feels vulnerable in some way, shape, or form, right? In this world, there are very few people who, you know, feel completely invulnerable in everyday life. And everyone has had issues. Everyone has had, most people really have had ways of not being seen, not being heard.
Yeah.
And I think that that resonates with people. And I think because of my experiences and because of being a woman of color, a woman in science, which was a relative minority in some way, an immigrant, I'm a proud, proud naturalized citizen. But I will tell you that, especially after the Trump election, there's very real fear.
Oh, yeah.
That even being a naturalized citizen was not enough to protect me. Yeah. And that whole idea of, you know, not being good enough or not quite fitting into society, after having spent all of this time and effort being a part of this fabric and feeling as if, wow, you know, with one stroke, this person can make me feel or make me really not be the same.
Right.
As everyone else. And I think that not just me, but really for other folks around me who are more vulnerable than I am, I think what resonates is the fact that I understand that. It's a really visceral understanding, and it right. really drives my perspective. It really drives, it's the motivation behind why I'm doing this. And I'm not doing this because, you know, somehow I think there's, you know, huge personal political gain out of this.
At least as far as I know, you don't really gain much personally by going through the pain of running for office. It's really a taxing experience, it seems.
So I think that people understand that. And people understand that what I'm doing this for is really fighting for what's right. And at the end of the day, you know, one of the compelling reasons for doing this is are my kids are looking at them and going, yeah, I'm going to have to explain to you what I did or didn't do.
Yeah.
In this time in history. I think we are all going to have to explain to ourselves what we did or didn't do.
Yeah. And on that note, what can people do to support you? Where can they find you? What can they do to support you? And well, both, you know, inside and outside of New Jersey, because there's lots of people that listen to this all over the world.
Yes, absolutely. So they can go to my website. It's artiforcongress.com. It's artiforcongress.com. And you can support me in multiple ways. We're always looking for money and fundraising because campaigns take money. And I'm not taking any corporate PAC money. I'm not taking any fossil fuel money. Whereas my opponent has a corporate war chest of about $6 million.
Oh my gosh.
My campaign is a grassroots, people-powered campaign. You know, we hit our first fundraising goal and we had an average donation of less than $100 per person. So that's what this is about. And we're going to win. We're going to win because the power of the people is way mightier than the power of his money.
Radicals and Revolutionaries Lab is a product of Continuum. Find me at Jillian J. Foster on all the socials and Continuum at We Are Continuum. That's W-E, the letter R, Continuum on Twitter and Continuum Collective on Instagram. Our show is produced by Ginny Saraswati and her team at Ginny Media. Thanks to Sarah Letitia Jansen for research and production support. Want to contribute to the R&R Lab? Join the Continuum Collective. If you're not a Continuum Collective member, you're missing out on all sorts of perks like exclusive events, the gender studies course of your dreams, and bragging rights to all your podcast-loving friends to let them know that you're supporting the boundary-pushing work we do at Continuum, including this podcast right here. Go to ContinuumCollective.org to join today. That's ContinuumCollective.org. I'm Jillian Foster. Until next time, sending you power, love, and solidarity.